This podcast is brought to you by Labyrinth Marketing.
Hello and welcome to The Whole Marketer. In this episode, we will talk about belonging, diversity and inclusion and equality in the workplace. The role of work is more than just to pay the bills. It's part of who we are and it aids us to contribute to the world and ultimately our purpose. Therefore, we are looking to work for organisations and brands that not only align with our values and beliefs, but also allow us to live to our purpose and contribute to the wide success of the organisation. We also want to be able to bring our true, authentic selves into any given situation, regardless of our gender, neurodiversity, LGBTQ plus disabilities, ethnicities, and any other boxes that we may sit in. We've still got a way to go before everyone feels that they can belong in workplaces that are free of bias and inclusive, which is why I wanted to bring today's guests on to talk about their book, Belonging, which looks at where we are and what's going on and how to create belonging for all and the actions we can take to make the cultural change we need for us to all belong. Today's guests are Catherine Jacob, Sue Unerman and Mark Edwards. Catherine Jacob, OBE, is CEO of Pearl & Dean, a cinema and advertising company. Sue Unerman is Chief Transformation Officer at Mediacom, the largest media agency in the UK with over 200 clients. And Mark Edwards is a Sunday Times journalist and qualified mindfulness coach who trains businesses in diversity and inclusion as well as leadership. Sue, Catherine and Mark, welcome to the Whole Marketing Podcast.
Thank you.
Hello.
So as always with the podcast, I start with a big juicy question up front. What is belonging to you?
Yeah, I've worked at the business that I'm working in since 1990. So obviously I was very young when I started. And before that, I'd changed job every 2-3 years, which is very normal in the advertising industry and very normal across the industry still. And the reason that I've stayed for such a long time at the company that I've stayed at is because I do really, truly have a sense that I belong there. And the reason that I have a sense that I belong there is because diversity and change and allowing people to be the best at who they are is baked into how we work. Our culture at Mediacom is people first, better results, and we really mean it. Now, what's clear is that that isn't the case everywhere. And what's clear from the levels of diversity in top boards, both across the UK and worldwide, is that people of all kinds of talent are not getting through to those top jobs. So belonging for me means having complete sense of acceptance where you work for exactly who you are and not having to pretend to be somebody else. And by doing that, by creating that culture, it means that you don't have to spend effort fitting in. You can spend the effort instead on being good at your job and helping your colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Sue. I think it's having that sense where when you go into work that you'll be supported and that you can have good days and you can have bad days, as everyone does. And you're not wearing a mask the whole time of trying to be in a certain way. You know, when you go to places and you go, we always do it this way. Just like, well, why do you always do it that way? It might not be such a good way. So it's that freedom and it's the sense of when you go to work, you're not having that weight put on your shoulders where you have to pretend to be someone else. And also where you know that where you work, you get promoted because of the job that you do, not because you play golf with the CEO or you fit a certain archetype that they've decided is the way that management and or supervision should look.
Yeah, I think I agree with all the above. I think belonging is about feeling that you are appreciated for who you actually are rather than for the role you play or for fitting into a certain type of behavior. I think it means that when you go to work, you feel that your strengths are valued, but also that people are accepting and compassionate about the areas where maybe you're not so strong. I think there's a lot of talk these days about bring your whole self to work. I don't think anybody has to bring their whole self to work. We're allowed to keep parts of ourselves away from work if we want. But belonging is feeling that you could bring your whole self to work if you wanted to, and that all the parts of you would be okay.
I love that. And the other thing I loved when I was reading the book was your manifesto for belonging. And one of the parts of your manifesto really resonated with me, which was around the need to train your people to develop their emotional intelligence. And self-awareness and empathy are two things that I often cover through The Whole Marketeer and also in my book. What do you believe organisations could do to help their people improve their emotional intelligence?
The most important thing would be to increase empathy. And there are very, very few people out there who are genuinely capable of a great deal of empathy. We know that because the way in which it's normally described is, how would you feel if you were in their shoes? That's not empathy. The whole point is they feel differently than you would feel in their shoes. And very few people get that they have to make that extra leap. Not how would I feel there, but how does somebody completely different from me feel? And possibly in a way that seems the opposite of how I would feel. That's the level of awareness of others that we need. So an organization really needs to do two things. You need to train individuals in increasing their self-awareness so they know how they show up and how they're perceived and what their behavior is doing and how it's impacting on people. Train to increase in awareness of others, other people's feelings. Really, ideally, you would train people to understand their relationship with their thoughts, what their thoughts are and what they're not, so that people aren't simply reacting to situations, but are able to pause and consider and reflect and respond. And also, in an ideal world, and I know we're a long way away from this, you would train people in how to feel their feelings, because we don't get taught that at school. And so people come into the office without very much emotional intelligence at all, at the most basic level of managing their emotions and being able to feel their emotions. And a large number of people act their emotions out, which just escalates negativity in the workplace. So I think if companies could train people in those areas and take the responsibility to do that, that would be fantastic. And I think that the other thing really is that people leading teams could get their teams to talk to each other and ask each other questions. So a team building exercise that I like to do and that we write about in the book is not team building as in all going whitewater rafting together, but just sitting down and talking to each other and everybody in the team answering the same questions. And they're really simple questions about, you know, what are you like on a good day and what are you like on a bad day? And when you're having a bad day, what kind of support do you want? And what kind of support do you very definitely not want? So this just opens people up to helping them have some empathy, even if it's not natural for them. Some people, when they're having a bad day, want a lot of support. Some people want to just be left alone to get their head down and get on with it and then get away as soon as possible. And you can be trying to help people and trying to be empathetic and doing exactly the wrong thing just because you've never asked them. So I think a culture in which teams talk to each other about their needs and their wants is really powerful. And of course, it's not a perfect world. It doesn't mean that all your needs will get met, but it's helpful if people around you know what your needs are.
I suppose that needs a level of your own self-awareness and also the space within the organisation for conversations around ways of working and what you need to be accepted, I guess.
Exactly. You need a culture where those kind of conversations are okay, which is why I think it starts at a team level. You need a group of people who are okay starting that, and then other teams will see that they're working really well together and they'll want to do it too.
I think the thing is, you have to create a culture. Some of it is about the way that you talk about how people are with each other, and it not being, I'm just in it for myself and all I'm being measured against is hitting my targets and doing this. If what we did was we created cultures in my organisation, I run a sales company, we have team targets and everybody's contribution is just as valued, because you're not in that hideous competition to go, oh, well, I made more money in February than you did. So, you know, and all that kind of thing. It has to be a celebration of the whole. Because otherwise you just end up in a situation where people just look out for themselves the whole time and they're not thinking actually what's going to be best for everyone. They just think this is all about me getting ahead, about me looking like the superstar. And the way that you treat people in their appraisals in terms of saying, how have you helped other people in the team? Were you the person who talk through the person who joined the accounts team as a trainee about how we sell cinema or how we do this, that kind of behaviour where that is noticed and celebrated more than being the top revenue earner or a certain thing, that there's different types of contributions and they are equally as valuable because they make the company better. I think that's the key as well about changing the metrics that we measure people on.
Yeah, different definition of success. And yeah, not just the what, but the how and the why.
I would just add that we're working in marketing. And so this empathy point that Mark makes, for me as a media strategist and planner, as well as transformation officer, without empathy to the people that we're trying to target, then you don't get good work, you don't get a good plan. And so learning better empathy skills will help develop us all round. The other point about this is that people are our assets as well as marketeers. We're not the people making the cans of baked beans. If we were the people making the cans of baked beans, we would make sure that our assets that were doing the work were working properly. You know, we would not look after our technical equipment. Mm. And in the world we work in, people are our resource. People are the things that make the difference. And so making sure that everybody is able to work to the best of their abilities is just so important. And I have to know that right now we are recruiting people with talent into organisations, and then if they don't have immediate cultural fit, we're not making them feel comfortable. We're not expanding the culture to make sure that they do feel comfortable and they feel as though they belong. And one of the people that I interviewed for the book, who is just a brilliant marketer, she's maybe one of the best marketeers I've ever met, and she talked about a time in her past career at a different company, and it was a market outside the UK. And let's say it was a market where deference to men from women is much more strongly a cultural norm than perhaps it is sitting in the London office. And she said that having employed her, she just felt as though she was being tripped up every single time she suggested something, or, you know, made to justify her appearance or her contribution. And you go, well, how stupid is that? You find somebody really good, you employ them, well done, big tick, mm, but then you make them feel so uncomfortable that they can't actually contribute. That's basically like getting yourself a new car or something, but instead of putting petrol in it, putting
diesel.
I was actually going to go 7-Up. It's just nonsense.
Yeah, just not fueling it with the right positivity and energy that it needs to thrive.
Much better for the environment, though, cars that run on 7-Up, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's coming.
And one of the things that shocked me when I was reading the book, first of all, the significant amount of money that's been spent or invested, $6 billion in inclusivity and diversity initiatives in the workplace. Astounding amount of money. The second thing is actually the limited amount of impact they've had. Why do you think that is?
It's an astounding amount of money that gets spent every year on diversity and inclusion initiatives. And you would have to go, I mean, as a media person, I like to know what the return on investment is. You have to question the returns. And we think it's because there's a couple of core reasons. There's this idea of diversity and inclusion fatigue, which applies both to the people whom the initiatives are meant to help, who are tired of being made to represent not only themselves, but their entire typology of person. So that idea when there's yet another day for encouraging fast stream young women in the company, and it's a day when those young women get told to show up for the entire generation that they represent, and that's on top of their day job, and yet things still don't change, so they're the poster girl for it. And this applies to all forms of underrepresented groups. So diversity fatigue hits in that way, but it also affects the people who are currently in charge. So there is still a huge amount of power. This isn't opinion, this is just fact, in the hands of straight white men. There's only 4 women CEOs and 6 Black and Asian minority ethnic CEOs on the FTSE 100. You're more likely to be a CEO of the FTSE 100 if you're called Steve than if you're a woman, for example. And those people are also tired of inclusion initiatives. And they're tired of them because they feel excluded and frequently attacked by them. And some of those people are mean the best, but they're very anxious about the high stakes of doing or saying something wrong and that being kind of career ending. There's a whole middle management permafrost level who look upwards and say to themselves, well, I'm never going to get promoted because I'm a straight white man and what are my chances? And therefore they do not buy into this. And so there's a legal concept called plausible deniability, which is basically when you claim that you can't do something and nobody can prove that that's wrong. So these people will be asked to promote and employ people from diverse backgrounds. And they'll say, I interviewed lots of them for the job, but I none of them were good enough. And so we've gone yet again with someone who looks and sounds like me. So I think there is a very deep-rooted problem. This is where this belonging book came from. Unless everybody regards it as their very special job to champion diversity and inclusion in the workplace, then diversity and inclusion initiatives, you can spend $25 billion on them and they won't work.
I think what's coming through to me is insecurity. There needs to be a level of security in yourself and in owning who you are before you can then bring anybody in that may differ from you. Is that a fair reflection?
I think security, but also you need to understand that it's not a zero-sum game. So if you become that person that champions diversity and inclusion, you're going to be surrounded by people of talent, by what Matthew Syed calls, you know, rebel ideas, rebel thinkers. And that will boost your career and also your company's career. So I think it's also about having perspective and a growth mentality rather than a fixed mentality. And this idea that if somebody else's career goes well, that must mean that yours is going badly. Not if the company's growing, it doesn't.
I think as well, Sue, there's that point that came out of our research, which 52% of people think that their bosses don't take personal responsibility for kind of making their workplaces inclusive. And so often the way that those conversations and things are constructed can feel sort of like a trap. So an example that Sue and I have talked about in the past is, you know, a very large bank in the UK. This is 4 years ago, Sue, 5 years ago. Mm. And they said, you know, what would make your life better than coming into this multi-story building in the city every day? And everyone said, oh, you know, we'd really like to remote work and that would be really great. And it was huge. It was off the scale in terms of what people wanted to do. So they went to huge steps, introduced it. I think it was 3% take up. And they couldn't work out why everybody had asked for it, but no one was doing it. And it turned out when they did some analysis was that because none of the senior managers were doing it, everyone thought it was a trap. And that if you did start remote working, you would then be accused of not being invested in your career. And it was the equivalent of putting a T-shirt on going, please, next time there's any cutbacks, I'm the first person to go. And so the person who introduced this said to me, the hardest thing we had wasn't actually introducing the policy. The hardest thing was getting senior managers to go, I am going to publicly not come to work on a Wednesday every other week. And I'm going to talk about the fact that I'm really enjoying taking my dog for a walk or picking my children up from school or having more thinking time and not being in meetings. And they were incredibly resistant to the idea that they couldn't be seen as so key to being in the building. And I think it is that thing where senior managers think we need to control this. And then people look up and go, yeah, but you don't really mean it, do you? Because you haven't really changed the board. Everybody you promote is a certain type. And I think it is that thing where managers have to get in with it, not just go, we've got a great head of talent. This is our latest initiative.
In addition to that, referring back to the research that was carried out for us by Donata, one of the things that was shocking for me in the research is that one in three people overall actually experience bias, harassment or inappropriate behaviour at work. And a large proportion of people that have witnessed that kind of behaviour. Now, apart from the fact that these figures are even worse for underrepresented groups, so, for example, 60% of people who identify as mixed race say that they've experienced this harassment, 36% of new mums, 48% of LGBTQ+, 59% of disabled people. But it's also the witnessing of it and being a bystander.
Yeah.
And I think this being a bystander behaviour, this is something that belongs to everybody in the organisation. So, yes, commitment from the leadership is really important. But if we all pledge that we would never be a bystander to those awkward moments again, when somebody does or says something that you know is upsetting somebody, but it's being passed off as banter or a joke, and there's a whole conversation to be had about banter, then the workplace would change. And if more and more people do that and do, you know, find a way of speaking up on behalf of each other, then the whole atmosphere improves. Now, we know this is difficult, which is one of the reasons why we asked Mark to, as you know, as a mindfulness coach and a trainer, we asked him to create a whole set of step-by-step exercises, because quite often when you're in that place where you want to challenge what somebody says, you actually feel very intimidated because perhaps they're the people who are about to do your 360 review or are responsible for recommending you for a pay rise or promotion. And the last thing you want to do is jeopardize that. But on the other hand, you know you should speak up. And so Mark's done some brilliant exercises about how to resolve that.
Mark, did you want to tell us about a few of those exercises so that this doesn't just set with the leaders in the organization?
So I think one of the key skills that help a company to have more of a belonging culture is if people actually learn how to disagree without having an argument. And it's perfectly possible for there to be a great deal of diversity of opinions and thought without everything turning into a row. And again, this does come back to emotional intelligence. You need everyone to understand that before the disagreement begins, they need to surface their thoughts and their feelings. They need to know what they're thinking and what they're feeling so that the feelings don't get converted into a row. You need people to understand what basically lies behind a disagreement, that there are normally three kinds of disagreement. And the first kind comes about because you're using different data than the other person, different facts. And the second kind comes about because you've got the same facts, but you're interpreting them differently. And the third kind is when you genuinely actually have different opinions. Now, most disagreements are in the first two areas. And if they are, there is just no need for a row at all. What you need to do is have an emotionally intelligent discussion about, well, what facts are you using here? What facts am I using? How are you interpreting those facts? Well, here's how I'm interpreting those facts. And you will come to an answer. And in the areas where, no, there's a genuine disagreement, again, you need emotional intelligence. You need to understand that, I'm going to exaggerate slightly, but more or less, nobody ever changed anybody's mind by telling them that they're wrong. It just doesn't happen. It's one of the huge flaws in our society is that people think, if I prove to this person they're wrong, they'll change their minds. It doesn't happen. That's not how you do it. If you spend your time telling someone else they're wrong, all they do is become more and more firmly confirmed in their belief that they're right. So you need people to have that much emotional intelligence to know that in order to change someone's opinion, what you have to do is give them the space to allow them to discover that actually what the right answer is themselves. So it's about having that kind of grown-up, emotionally intelligent approach to disagreement, really. And there's a lot more detail about it, and there's a lot more in the book. Those are the kind of areas that you need to explore. And I think just as I'm saying them here, I think you can all just instantly think, that's not how it happens in most meetings. You know, that's not what people naturally do at work. So there's a huge area to improve there.
For those that are sat here listening, smiling and nodding like me, thinking, I want to feel like I belong at work. I want to have disagreements that don't end in sides having to be taken and long drawn out conversations. You know, I want to work in a place where I belong and I allow others to feel like they belong. What advice would you give them?
I think start with yourself and think, what can I do every day that's going to make a difference? Am I going to be the person who, to Mark's point earlier, which is, talks to people in my team and you're open and you say, I'm having trouble sleeping at the moment, and have you ever had that? I have actually had this conversation with someone I work with, because I went through a phase, I had about a week where I didn't sleep very well and I knew I was getting grumpy, and I just said to my colleague Claire, I'm having real trouble sleeping at the moment, have you had that? And she said, oh god, yeah. She said, I had it about 6 months ago and I did this and I did that. And just knowing that she kind of had had it as well, I felt supported, she felt she wasn't alone. And it is that thing about just being, I know it sounds very weird, but just being human to each other, rather than as you walk in, you put your face on, you put your armour on, you go and you're there to fight, win, achieve. Actually, you're there to win together and support each other and not see work as some kind of adversarial contest. And just speak up for people, look out for people, and show your humanity. If you set the example, I think it is that thing where you'd be surprised at how many other people are just looking for that cue.
Yeah, you create the ripple effect.
Yeah.
That permission to be your true, authentic self. And I loved the analogy that was given in the book around wearing a glass slipper, where you pretend to be anything but your true self. Because it's so true. In my early career, there was definitely a feeling of having to put your armour on, the corporate dress, the corporate heels, the lipstick, and be ready to kind of take on anything that gets thrown in the day. And I'd like to think things are changing, but obviously we've still got a long way to go.
Well, I think it is just that thing about being confident that you're doing the right thing and knowing that actually you're creating somewhere where, I will say this because Sue can't say this, but look at Mediacom, you know, hugely successful, lots of people there, all of whom are enabled to be their true selves. And you don't get a sense that there's this corporate speak where you just get autobots who always speak the same, always say the same. It's kind of like a happy fruit salad of different people who all make their own contribution.
One of the things that struck me when I first joined the business that I now work for is called Mediacom now. When I first joined it, it was called the media business, and it was quite a small startup in the media planning and buying sector, very ahead of its time, one of the first media independents. And I'd never worked anywhere before where if you had a good idea that you could back up and you could justify, I hadn't worked anywhere where people didn't tell you that you couldn't possibly do it because that's not how they did things before. So where I'd worked before that, if I'd said, look, I've come up with this new idea, people would go, well, that's a great idea, Sue, but that's not how we've been doing things, and it would be very difficult to change it. And also, we've been telling clients this is the way to do it, and so we don't really want to go back to them and tell them that we've changed things, which is such closed thinking and so defensive. And when I first arrived at the media business, what shone out was that if you had an idea, and of course you had to justify it, people would try it. And you know what? We're still doing that. And the other thing is that when I joined, I mean, it was only men on the board. So it was a much smaller company. We billed for £50 million, about 45 people. We now bill in excess of £1.5 billion in the UK, and we're a global top media planning and buying and content creation agency. But the growth from when I first joined to now, obviously, clearly, there's been periods when it was just exponential organic growth and winning of accounts because we were changing what we were doing. But the business that I joined, that boardroom had not seen a woman other than arranging the teacups and pouring the tea until I joined the board. But I was welcomed onto the board because I had a different point of view. And that's very much still how we would operate. So we would talk about the fact that in order to join senior management, what we want is we want people who will add to our playlist, not duplicate it. I used to say record collection, but now I say playlist because not everybody has records. Being able to accept people in that have got different skill sets and different points of view, but not have them feel as though they've got to fit a certain type of culture, that's really the key and that's really the secret. And the point is to love the difference and love the challenges and not to be defensive about it. Having that kind of culture, it's very self-fulfilling. So you attract sort of people who love to challenge things and create points of difference, whereas closed cultures tend to stay small, or, you know, perhaps they have their run because they're successful for a period, but then they run out of steam. And I think there's just this notion of cultural fit that has been predominating around so far this century that I think is a big mistake. So there's this idea that, you know, we interviewed, you know, five people of talent, but George, he really had the right cultural fit. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that he's exactly like the rest of you? Because if what that means is that he'll play, as you said right at the beginning of the call, Abigail, if that means that he plays five-a-side football on a Wednesday evening with the rest of you, and he's happy to participate in the banter that the boss deals out, that's great. That means that what he's really good at is five-a-side football and a bit of banter. That doesn't necessarily mean, and good at getting promoted, it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be good at getting the job done in a different way or a new way, or changing and transforming things for the better. So I think cultural fit is a notion that I would like us to really, I want to say chuck out, but it's led to some of that sense that the glass slipper, because, you know, obviously the original story of Cinderella and the glass slipper, the original kind of Brothers Grimm story, it's not as sweet as the Disney version. She actually has her toes cut off. So the ugly sisters have their toes cut off to fit the glass slipper. And it's the idea that you're squeezing yourself into a stereotype in order to get on in the office. You should not have to do that.
And talking about getting on in the office, I also loved, and for the listeners, is advice that you gave around the six people you need to support you in your work. I thought it was a really great practical piece of advice. As always with the whole Marketeer podcast, speaking about advice, we always finish the podcast with one piece of advice you'd give for marketeers of tomorrow. So if I could ask each of you to answer that question.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm certainly not a marketing expert, but for anybody, the piece of advice I would give them is ask three questions for every one statement you make. Make that your rule at work as a guide. If everybody did that, we would be far more inclusive. Now, no one's going to do that because it's something to aim for rather than something you're actually going to achieve. But if we could think about asking questions about clarifying what people are saying, clarifying what they need, clarifying what they're how they're feeling, instead of going into a meeting and making statements about what you need and what you want and your deadlines and your KPIs, then we'd have a much kinder, more respectful, more belonging workplace. I use this with people I coach, and I say, okay, try and do that tomorrow. Three questions for everyone's statement. And we come back and, how did you do? Not very well. But the fact that you know that you're not doing it makes you do be a little bit more someone who asks helpful questions and clarifying questions rather than making statements. And if we could just all move that dial slightly, and by questions, I don't mean why the hell haven't you done X or whose fault was this? I mean questions to find out more about the other person and their feelings and their needs. If we could just move the dial a little bit more to people having that approach in meetings and other interactions at work, we would have a kinder, more belonging workplace.
So there's been lots of talk recently about this concept of the microaggression, and we write about it, as you know, in the book. What I would say is, in order to be a better champion of belonging, diversity and inclusion, practice the micro affirmation. So this is the antidote to the microaggression. It's much less well known, but it means being inclusive of people, being welcoming of people. It means saying things like, I think perhaps nobody heard Abigail's great contribution just a minute ago. Abigail, would you just like a moment to say that again if you feel that somebody's been talked over in a meeting? So practice the micro affirmation.
I think that for all marketers, it is that thing which campaigns get called out when they're a bit tone deaf. Those campaigns tend to happen when you're not reflecting the audiences that you serve and you're not talking to them and saying, what is it you want? What is it you need? And fully understanding and getting to know your audience. And I think that you should bring belonging not only to your team, so when you look around, you know that you've got a great, rich, diverse set of opinions and thought process and people in there. That will also enable you that when you put your great marketing campaigns out there, you won't get audiences saying, do you think you're talking to me? That isn't what I think. This isn't who we are. You're just imposing your views on us. And I think it's a dual thing about making sure that you're enabling your teams to talk authentically to each other and also to your audiences.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Whole Marketeer podcast. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please do click follow below for more weekly podcasts. Thank you.